Voice of the International African Revolution.
They got lions and elephants captive. They got panthers and jackals and giraffes. They take them all out of Africa and stare at them from behind glass. They go to the zoo with their families. They buy balloons and popcorns and candies. They point and laugh at the monkeys and never think that they might be unhappy. They got animals in the zoo taking Prozac until their eyes are a glassy blank. And if you're a black man, you know that it's the lion who understands. He knows how you feel when you wake up in fear of the whole world's gaze. You are a mask you can never let break up, and the world closes in like a cage. And some smoke crack on the corners, and some of the poor ones sniff gas, and the animals in the zoo chew their fur off and wait for this lifetime to pass. And the black men kill other black men like a fox bites his leg in a trap. When others are holding you hostage, it's always yourself you attack. And the giraffe just wants his freedom. That's why he's so sad. And they locked the panthers in prison. And we both have some rich man to thank. They said the animal's just like the black man. They said he's only safe in his cage. And so they took us from Africa and held us all hostage as slaves. And right when our slavery ended is right when the zoos began. They said, I guess we gotta own something if we can't get our black man back. They said, you better work like a dog boy. They said, you better obey our laws. They said, keep your eyes on the ground, boy, and they clip the lion's claws. They made that movie Free Willy. It made millions for them in the bank. And after the filming was over, they threw that whale back in a tank. They made trillions of dollars off slavery using the black man's tool. And after the slave trade was over, they didn't even give us our mule. It costs $1 million a year for a panda. That's the price of freedom these days. They say that the panda is valuable and they won't give us a fair wage. But if they really valued the panda, they'd know his freedom can never be priced. So what they're really paying for is the right to fuck with his life. They line up outside of the stadium. They pay boxers to batter their brains. Look what they done to Muhammad Ali, but they put Michael Vick in jail. They watch anything if it's degrading. They watch monkeys play with their poo. The monkeys keep them entertained. They make this whole world their zoo. They love us best when we're cartoons. They love rap stars and Winnie the Pooh. They got Flavor Flav on the TV, acting for them like a coon. And now they look in our faces and try to pretend that they've changed. And the zookeepers take their paycheck and say that the breeds are saved. They say the zoos are about conservation. They say that it's all in the past. They say a black man's elected president. They say racism's over at last. They say the lions would die without them. They call all the species endangered. They act like we all should be grateful they pay for the problems that they created. And now everyone's into the planet, and they tell us all to be green, but we all know the biggest danger this planet has ever seen.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada, in the not-so-great white north. I am the resident bluesologist, and we came out of the box tonight with the music of L. Jones. Well, L. Jones is a spoken word artist, but spoken word is music. And she is out of Halifax, Nova Scotia, and she will be joining us on November 9th when we raise funds for Uhuru Radio. First of all, I would like to thank two people, Chairman Omali Ishitella, the chair of the African People's Socialist Party, and Archie Shepp, two gentlemen from Florida, for whatever that is worth. Chairman Omali gave me the space on Uhuru Radio to do diasporic music. And Archie Shepp gave me the concept of diasporic music, music made in the West, but not of the West. And we cheat and we play music from the African continent. But you know, diasporic music is music from Brazil, from Trinidad and Tobago, from Jamaica, from Halifax, Nova Scotia, from Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana. Music that we make in the Western Hemisphere, we play a lot of that, and we are going to play some Trinidad music pretty soon. But first of all, I would like to let everyone know that Diasporic Music is one of the shows that you hear on Uhura Radio, and we hope you enjoy it. But you can also catch O'Malley Ishitella Speaks. That's Chairman O'Malley Ishitella does a lot of great speeches on interviews and speeches on his own show, O'Malley Ishitella Speaks. Africa Live is hosted by Didon Sankara, and that is a show that you should definitely check out. Reparations in Action is the host is Penny Heft, and you should definitely check out that. We also have Black Agenda Report, which is produced, and the host is the producer and host of Black Agenda Radio is Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey, and Ron Bob Simple is so nice. He comes on twice. He's on Caribbean Forum. That's on Saturday, and he has Golden Sunday Sounds. That comes on later on today, and I think he will be featuring Minnie Riperton, the perfect angel, Minnie Riperton. And definitely stay tuned to Uhuru Radio. But right now, I guess I should tell you, today is we're paying tribute to Al Prentice Bunchy Carter, who was born on October 12th, 1942 in Shreveport, Louisiana. And we're going to be speaking with a young man by the name of Lyndon Beckford. He's going to be talking about Al Prentice Bunchy Carter. We're also going to be talking to Jeanette Baker. We talked to Jeanette Baker last week, but we're going to bring her back, and she's going to talk about the Los Angeles situation. And we're going to feature a lot of music from Los Angeles, California. We're going to be playing some Jesse Belvin, some Jeanette Baker, Betty Swan, the Larks. So we're going to be featuring Eminem and the Peanuts, a group that I used to sing with, and the Shields. And the Clicks, that was Jesse Belvin and Eugene Church, a man who sang a song called Pretty Girls Everywhere. And we're going to continue with some more spoken word and diasporic music on Uhuru Radio continues. It's
I tell you, run quick and spread the word. Let the word be heard. What? Rapso take over. Rapso take over. Heat in the place, but they can't hold the fire. Heat in the place, but they can't hold the fire. Rapso take over. Rapso take over. And spread the word. Let the word be heard. What? Rapso take over. Rapso take over. Run quick and spread the word. Let the word be heard. What? Rapso take over. Rapso take over. Heat in the place, but they can't out the fire. Heat in the place, but they can't out the fire. Rapso take over. Rapso take over. Heat in the place, but they can't out the fire. In the place where they can't hold the fire. Rapso take over. Rapso take over. Rapso. 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 We dump penetration for true liberation. Rapso. Rapso. Redemption of ancient tradition. Rapso, Rapso, the power of the word, the rhythm of the word. Rapso, Rapso, the voice of a people in the height of the struggle. Rapso, Rapso. Danger, danger, run for shelter. Danger, danger, run.
for exposure. Get ready for Baghdad right in the street. Get ready for that. Let's let it be your name. Get ready for him. Get ready for them. Get whatever, for whatever happens to this world. Be ready. Just say, people, people, get ready. Stay ready. Let ready be your name.
Get ready.
Get ready for anything. For something you love.
Baragani, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Richmond, and we were listening to the music of William Parker featuring Lena Conquest and Amiri Baraka, and that was a song written by Curtis Mayfield, the late, great Curtis Mayfield. It was re-recorded by Al Green and that song, the lyrics, some of the lyrics from People Get Ready were incorporated into Bob Marley's One Love. So when you hear or buy One Love by Bob Marley, you're putting money into the Bob Marley estate as well as the Curtis Mayfield estate, because that song, People Get Ready, is incorporated in One Love, One Love. We also heard from Brother Resistance out of Trinidad and Tobago, and he, the type of music he does, or it's music, but it's called Rapso. He's rapping over the Calypso or the Soca music, and very good piece, and we're going to be playing more Rapso on Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. We're going to be speaking with Lyndon Beckford about Bunchy Carter pretty soon. We're also going to be speaking to Jeanette Baker. But right now we're going to play a group from Los Angeles, California. And they went to a high school called Dorsey High School. And we're going to play two selections from a group called the Young Hearts. And this is Do You Have the Time from the Young Hearts.
You know, us go to life, never realizing our true potential, never really pursuing our positive goals. Sometimes we even procrastinate to ourselves and say what we can do tomorrow instead of what we can do today, further saying that if it wasn't for this, then I would have that. But what we are really doing is missing the whole point. As an old man once told me, son, if you don't wake up, you're gonna miss the boat. And this is what we let happen to a lot of our lives. Sometimes we fail to ask ourselves that main question, and that is, do we really have the time to waste our life away? Do we have the time to go through life always putting things off instead of really bearing down and working diligently into bringing the best of us out? You know, this is a brand new day. Each and every morning that you open your eyes is the beginning of the rest of your life. So sometimes when trouble seems to get us down and life really seems too hard to bear, then we must pick ourselves up and then ask ourselves that question again. Do you really have time to waste our life away?
Uhuru, you are listening to Darius Bork Music on Uhuru Radio. This is Norman Richmond, and we were listening to the Young Hearts, a group out of Dorsey High School, and they did a song called I've Got Love for My Baby, as well as Do You Have the Time? And I used to have a show on radio station Chin Radio here in Toronto called Do You Have the Time? And Bunchy Carter, John Huggins, the late John Huggins, and Elaine Brown used to sing that song when that song was out before Bunchy and John were assassinated. Bunchy was a great vocalist, nice falsetto singer, and Kwame Ture used to always talk about when you mentioned Bunchy, he would say, "Yeah, falsetto, yeah," because Bunchy sang that falsetto. But joining us on the line from Los Angeles, California, is Lyndon Beckford Jr. And Lyndon attended Grambling State University in Louisiana. He majored in history, and he is currently working on the biography of Al Prentice Bunchy Carter, and it's due out 2015. So, Lyndon, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. How's everything? And you're up in Toronto, Canada.
And the Great White North is getting ready to get getting ready to get cold up here. But it's fall, and it's right now. It's pretty good. But okay. we have the poem that Bunchy used to do called In Town. I don't want to use the word on Uhuru Radio and they bleep it out. But we're going to play. Al Prentice Bunchy Carter was a poet, and we have this is a very brief poem, but let us listen to Al Prentice Bunchy Carter reciting In Town.
Nicktown, the streets are made of mud, infested with rat and bat and bug. In Nicktown, the streets are made of brick. Ask any swinging that happens past, why won't he get up off his big fat funky? In Nicktown one day, four little children kneeled to pray. In Jesus' name, boom, four little children gone.
And that was Al Prentice Bunchy Carter, the poet, reading his poem, In Town. Now, before we talk about Bunchy, can we talk about the migration of African people? Bunchy was born on October the 12th, 1942 in Los Angeles. No, he was born in Shreveport, Louisiana. But many people left Shreveport, Louisiana, and left Texas. I think, okay, the original Panthers were Little Bobby Hutton. He was born in Arkansas, and then Bobby Seale was born in Texas, and Huey Newton was born in Louisiana. So could you briefly give us a rundown of the migration pattern from the people that came to Los Angeles and where they came from?
Well, according to the research I've done and people I've talked to, you know, you have people who black folk who migrated. Well, first of all, let me say this. You always had people coming to California and other places, going back to post-slavery, going back to during the World War I era. But the migration from the South to the West Coast and other places increased. And out here on the West Coast in California, they came primarily from Texas, Louisiana, some from Arkansas, some from Oklahoma, and then a few from Mississippi. But the bulk came from Texas and Louisiana.
Right.
Which would explain the very strong Louisiana culture that's here in California. Matter of fact, it's reflected in some of the Louisiana-based restaurants.
In terms of the fish places, and a lot of the restaurants are, some of them are, I guess, New Orleans, and some of them are other parts of Louisiana-based restaurants. That's what you're talking about?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, Bunchy Carter was the deputy minister of the defense of the Southern California chapter of the Black Panther Party, and the captain of the organization was a man by the name of John Huggins. Now, John Huggins was from Connecticut, but it's interesting, and a lot of people don't know it, but he had some Caribbean roots. Could you talk about how he and Bunchy coming out of Bunchy grew up in Los Angeles, so how this brother, who was, I guess, for all practical purposes, was a middle class brother, and Bunchy was came out of a working class background. Could you talk about the relationship between our apprentice Bunchy Carter and John Huggins?
Well, you're right. As far as John Huggins goes, yeah, his background was a lot different from Bunchy's, and by extension, some other people who were in the party. John Huggins, coming from New Haven, Connecticut, first off, born and raised, and as far as his Caribbean roots goes, the Caribbean connection is on his father's side. His father was from Nevis, the island of Nevis. And John Huggins, as you pointed out, came from a more middle-class background. However, it's commendable that when he came to California at the behest of his wife, Erica Huggins, because she felt compelled to get involved with the Black Panther Party. So when they came to L.A., they went searching for the Black Panther Party, and they connect with Bunchy Carter. So it's my understanding that they, clicked at the outstart. So what ends up happening is that in many ways, the people who were in the party embraced John Huggins. And I want to point this out, that it's commendable given the fact that Bunchy's background, he had served time in the penitentiary, he was a Slauson, so on and so forth. He obviously saw something very unique in John Huggins and for him to, connect with him like that. So I think it's commendable that given John Huggins' background, that he was able to not only with Bunchy, but others in the back, and he felt compelled to get involved in the movement.
Now, Bunchy was born in Shreveport, Louisiana, and I guess we should mention the fact that Masai Hewitt, a.k.a. Bright Eyes, also came from Shreveport, Louisiana, and
right.
could you talk about the whole Bunchy and the relationship between Bunchy and Masai Hewitt?
Well, it's my understanding that they both were had Shreveport, Louisiana roots. I don't know whether their families knew each other prior to coming to California, but they met up as young children in the Slauson neighborhood, and they grew up together, and they both were a part of the movement. What ends up happening is, at some point, Raymond Masai Hewitt goes into the Marine Corps after graduating from Fremont, and Bunchy is working at a department store on Wilshire, not far from May Company. And so there's a point when Bunchy goes to prison for armed robbery and does time in Soledad. And during this time period, Masai Hewitt comes back. I'm not clear on whether, I don't believe Masai Hewitt was a Vietnam vet. I know he served time in the Marine Corps. I'm not clear at this point where he served, but at any rate, he comes back to L.A. in the mid-60s, and at some point, one, gets enrolled at Cal State L.A., and two, gets involved with the United Front, which was a where he gets steeped in the study of Marxism, and it's primarily a Maoist group. And it's at this point, not long after, actually, that Bunchy gets paroled from prison and connects with or reconnects with Masai Hewitt, and Masai recruits Bunchy into the United Front. Not long after that, Eldridge Cleaver gets in contact with Bunchy Carter, because Eldridge Cleaver and Bunchy Carter meet each other in Soledad prison. And there was a point when they were part of, created the African History and Culture Club. That was actually a creation of Eldridge Cleaver. And one of the things that was significant is that both he and Eldridge Cleaver, Bunchy Carter that is, Bunchy Carter and Eldridge Cleaver consider themselves Malcolmites. So they were both Muslim in the penitentiary.
They were in the Nation of Islam in the penitentiary.
That's right. They were in the Nation of Islam. And I should point this out, that prior to Bunchy's incarceration, he was actually in the Nation of Islam as a teenager in the late 1950s. So contrary to what we see on Wikipedia, you'll be led to believe that his call to Islam came about as a result of his incarceration when he was in the Nation of Islam as a teenager. As a matter of fact, he was one of the first FOIU in Los Angeles.
Fruit of Islam, right?
Yes, and he was inspired by the teachings of Malcolm X in terms of the gospel of the War of Armageddon as taught by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. That being said, while Eldridge Cleaver and Bunchy Carter were incarcerated, they were looking to go into to create the California chapter of the OAAU, which is Malcolm X's Organization of Afro-American Unity. This is after Malcolm had been assassinated. However, once Eldridge Cleaver and Bunchy Carter are paroled, and Eldridge Cleaver goes up to the Bay Area, and he connects with Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, he realizes that all the stuff that he and Bunchy Carter were discussing and talking about creating, that Huey Newton and Bobby Seale were already doing. So there was no need to reinvent the wheel, so to speak. So he gets in contact with Bunchy Carter. Bunchy Carter comes up north, gets introduced to Bobby Seale, Huey Newton, likes what he sees, likes what he hears, and joins the Black Panther Party. And then at some point, he creates the Los Angeles chapter of the Black Panther Party. And keep in mind, this is the first chapter outside of the Oakland chapter. And he, in turn, recruits Masai Hewitt into the Black Panther Party. And Masai Hewitt, of course, becomes the Minister of Education. And Bunchy is the Deputy Minister of the Defense.
Right. Now, could you talk about, we want to talk about some of the, you know, Panthers have lost, the L.A. chapter of the Panthers have lost a couple of members in the last month or so. But before we talk about that, could we talk about January 17th, 1969, and the whole, the fact that Al Prentice Bunchy Carter was assassinated along with John Huggins on January the 17th, and many people say it had something to do with COINTELPRO. Other people believe that it was a hit, you know, by Ron Karinga's group, the US organization. And it's my understanding that the people that actually murdered Bunchy and John escaped, and the people that were actually charged with the crime really didn't do it. They were there, but they didn't do it. But could you talk about that January 17th, 1969?
Well, that's 45 years ago, and to this day, there are a lot of unanswered questions, but I can give you as much as I've been able to put together. In order to understand that day, we also have to look at what was happening prior to. What I mean by that is, from what we understand, a man by the name of Ron Karinga was trying to push for a man by the name of Charles W. Thomas to head the Black Studies Department at UCLA. And So there was some controversy involved in that. And there was a meeting that took place on January 17, 1969 in Campbell Hall. And John Huggins and Bunchy Carter were there, as well as other students. And at some point, the way the story goes, there was some kind of confrontation of some sort that went on between an US member and Elaine Brown. And one thing leads to another, and sounds like John Huggins confronted him. And I'm still not clear of all the details, but at any rate, John Huggins confronts him, and Bunchy Carter comes between them and
trying to break it up, right? Yeah.
Yes, and word headed that John Huggins was the one who fired the first shot, but that is not, that doesn't seem to be accurate, because in the first place, John Huggins was shot in the back by an US member, and the same US member who shot John Huggins shot a Bunchy Carter in the chest. And from what I understand, John Bunchy Carter died instantly, whereas with John Huggins, on the other hand, when he was shot, he had his gun in it, but I should also point out that Bunchy was unarmed that day. So therefore he was vulnerable. And so what ends up happening is that there's pandemonium, of course, and in many ways it's similar to some degree. It's similar to what happened with Malcolm X in terms of the assassination on his life. Well, the Steiner brothers, who were eventually convicted for the crime, claimed that they did not shoot Bunchy, but a guy named Claude Hubert, a.k.a. Cherchese, was the actual shooter. And so Cherchese flees the country and goes all the way to South America, Guyana, I believe. And then the Steiner brothers turn themselves in, and a trial takes place, and they're convicted and sentenced to prison in San Quentin. 5 years later, they somehow escape, and there's some controversy regarding that. They escape out of San Quentin and go to South America.
Guyana.
And
Forbes Burnham, Guyana, right.
Yes, and so they have obviously gotten some kind of asylum from Forrest Burnham. And this is the same Forrest Burnham who was hostile politically towards Walter Rodney, but that's a discussion for another day. But I must add this, that killing that took place, and I won't trivialize it by calling it an incident, but it was an assassination. And when people say assassination, it indicates what separates us that from other killings is that assassination has political implications. And for anybody in today's environment to believe that what happened on January 17, 1969 was happenstance, or was happenstance, is either naive, or at best, or at worst, very dishonest. That's no different from what happened with Malcolm X. It's no different from what happened with Fred Hampton, and Mark Clark months later in 69. It's interesting to note a couple things. January 17, 1969, this is the beginning of the year, and you have a double homicide of two Panther members in L.A., John Huggins and Bunchy Carter. Then towards the end of the year, in December 4th, 1969, you had Fred Hampton and Mark Clark who were assassinated in Chicago. So, you know, the year starts off bad, and then it ends bad. And then, of course, 4 days after Fred Hampton and Mark Clark are killed, you have the shootout on 41st and Central in Los Angeles. So it's just it's clear that the Panther Party was under assault.
Okay, I'm speaking with Lyndon Beckford, and I basically wanted to say that January 17th is also significant because on January 7th, 1961, Patrice Lumumba, Maurice Mpolo, and I forgot the other brother's name. There were three brothers that were assassinated in the Congo, and I have to kick myself because Morrison Polo, and go to Google and get there. Was three brothers that were killed that day, the same day, but in 1961. Now, we just lost, you mentioned the shootout, Los Angeles shootout. Two members that were in the shootout basically have lost their lives or passed away in the last month. Could you talk about those two brothers?
Yes. First, we lost Wayne Farr, who was a member of the Los Angeles chapter of the Black Panther Party, who was 19 years old at the time of the shootout on 41st and Central. He had been having some health issues in recent times. We lost him last month, and I was able to attend the service. It was well attended. I looked around, and next thing I know, the church was packed. So we lost him. He was 64 years of age. And then we just lost, back, I think, next day or two will be a week since we lost
Ronald Freeman,
who was a member of the Black Panther Party in Los Angeles, and who, too, was part of the shootout between the Black Panther Party and the LAPD. And he had been battling cancer for quite some time. Surprisingly, he actually showed up at Mr. Wayne Farr's funeral last month. And so he fought this thing to the end, which, shows the indomitable fighting spirit of, many of our people.
Right. The people that were died with Patrice Lumumba were Maurice Mpolo and Joseph Okito. Yeah. So yeah, gotta right. get my history right. But
okay.
Ronald Freeman was going back out of New York. They were trying when I was in LA, when we were together in LA, they were trying to raise funds for him to go to Cuba to get treatment. Did that ever take place? Did he ever get to Cuba?
It's my understanding that didn't happen. There was an attempt to get him there, but from what I understand, that never happened, unfortunately.
Now the Cubans, I guess we should definitely talk about the Cubans treated Stokely Carmichael, A.K.A. Kwame Ture, for cancer. And talking about Cuba, I guess when we go back to Al Prentice Bunchy Carter was really a he was influenced by C.L.R. James's book The Black Jacobin, but he was really into Jean-Jacques Dessalines and Didon Kimathi of the Land and Freedom
right.
Army, which is so-called Mau Mau in the Haitian Revolution. We have about 5 minutes left. Could you talk about that?
Yes. Two things. One, Bunchy, as a youngster, was exposed to the Mau Mau struggle that was taking place in the 1950s. So that's one of the events that helped to shape and mold his outlook internationally, and also connect what was happening with our African brothers and sisters, what was happening here. All of this, this the attempt of the quote-unquote dark nation to cast off the yoke of imperialism, colonialism, racism, and any other type of ism. So you fast forward to when Bunchy was locked up in Soledad Prison. That's one of the areas that he would study in the African History and Culture Class, which was the Mau Mau struggle. In fact, it's my understanding that he brought the Mau Mau Oath into...
You had to take the Mau Mau Oath in order to join the Los Angeles chapter of the Black Panther Party. Let me ask you a question.
That's right.
Did the other chapters adopt that, or was that just Bunchy's... Was that just a Los Angeles thing, the Mau Mau Oath?
That's a good question. I haven't looked into that, but that's something I definitely want to do because I'm curious myself to know if that's something that was unique to the Los Angeles chapter. The other thing I wanted to point out was that with regard to the Haitian Revolution in Dessalines, that is something that Bunchy Carter definitely studied when he was in Soledad Prison, because it's my understanding that the African History and Culture class, that is one of the works that they would... read and study and discuss was the
C.L.R. James
Revolution.
That was the Black Jacobins, right?
Black Jacobins, yes, by C.L.R. James. And so all this shows is that When you talk about all of that, when you're talking about, as I mentioned earlier, an indomitable fighting spirit. And unfortunately, in today's environment, in spite of all of what you have, with all these books that have been written by progressive, mostly progressive Jewish lefties that point out, like Herbert Aptheker, to be a slave, points out that you had maroon societies right here in the American South. I mean, most signs when people hear about the Maroons, they think of either Brazil, Suriname, Jamaica, etc. But when you mention Maroons, folks, they kind of look at you like, what? Yes, you had Maroons in the American South. And so the point I want to stress is that Bunchy was in that radical tradition of the Maroon that existed. So there is no doubt in my mind that, of course, I couldn't tell you about his family lineage, but it would be safe to say that he was a descendant of a rebellious African who was on the plantation, who is in the vernacular of the black human, who didn't take no stuff.
Well, let me say, because we basically run out of time, but could you mention Al Prentice Bunchy Carter's mother, who is still alive, and she is she basically produced Bunchy, and Bunchy had a brother. Bunchy's brother was the first Panther, I think, to get killed, his older brother. Could you talk about that?
Yes, he had a brother by the name of Arthur Morris, who was Bunchy's bodyguard in the Panther Party, and he was killed.
That was his older brother.
Yes, he was his older brother. He was killed March of 1968. I believe March 13th of 1968. So Bunchy was killed just about a year after his brother was killed. And as far as Mrs. Carter goes, in order to understand Bunchy, you've got to look at Mrs. Carter. Mrs. Carter has been a stalwart in the black community for decades. And so in order to understand Bunchy, you've got to look at the well which he sprang from. And that is somebody like Mrs. Carter. His mother is 96 years old today, 96. We're very fortunate to still have her around with us, because there are many people who are her contemporaries who have passed on. I mean, she has even outlived some people who are her junior. So it's quite possible she could still be around here with us for another 4 or 5 years.
Okay. But we have to bring you on again, but I really appreciate this interview, and it's been my honor to speak to you and to commemorate the, 73rd birthday of Al Prentice Bunchy Carter, who I didn't mention it, but I knew Bunchy Carter. I went to school with Bunchy, although Bunchy was 4 years older than me, but I went to LACC with Bunchy, and the last thing I'll say is that Bunchy, a talent show which was organized. Sagidi Abdullah, who wrote the song Baby Take Your Time Do It Right, told me that Bunchy came up with the idea, and Sagidi Abdullah was there. Also, there was a brother by the name of Ranji Southern, who was now he is Malik El Bey. He went to the same school I went to. He was there, and Fred Gorey, who became Masai Kariga Kenyatta, he was there. He became a DJ in Detroit, and also Earl Randall, who brother wrote a lot of songs for Tear My House Down and a lot of R&B songs with Al Green. He was there too, and Bunchy put that together. But I really appreciate you coming on, and thank you very much.
Well, it's been an honor. Any time you need me, I'm there.
All right, sir. So take care of yourself.
All right now.
And we have been speaking with Lyndon Beckford Jr. And Diasporic Music continues. I guess we're going to listen to Lisa's going to put on some spots, and I'll come black.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
There are more U.S. reporters covering the New York Yankees than there are covering the entire continent of Africa.
And it's a shame when we as African people, we make up damn near the majority of the city, but we have to fight to get on white ruling class media.
That tells you something about the priorities of the news media in this country.
We are engaged in a war of ideas.
Warning.
You're locked in to Uhuru Radio.
Stand by.
Right here, right now.
APSP, UhuruRadio.com.
All right then. I and I no mix with the wicked men. I and I said trample it.
Uhuru Radio was envisioned as a means by which our community, our people, our party, our revolutionary aspirations could contend with the ruling class in this war of ideas that contributes to maintaining the oppression of African people. Part of what African internationalism, Garveyism in the 21st century is about is ending that isolation, is bringing African people together in common struggle. And Uhuru Radio, it allows Africans in any place in the world to have access to other Africans so that reinforcement are always on the way, no matter where it is that we're struggling and no matter what may be the temporary setbacks.
Finally, the station you've been looking for.
Uhuru Radio. No degrading lyrics.
I never call you my bitch or even my boo. It's so much in the name and so much more in you.
Progressive.
And you love her like you are. So you buy her a diamond. If I want to die, oh, don't you think there's something wrong with it?
And millions of dollars leave Sierra Leone in the form of diamonds, yet the people who mine the diamonds make 30 cents a day and a cup of rice. That's the reality all over Africa.
And revolutionary.
AFDEF is an organization of the Uhuru movement that was built in 2007 in order to organize African doctors, nurses, scientists, engineers, and other skilled Africans around the world to coordinate a variety of development projects that work to transform the miserable conditions of existence that have been imposed on our people around the world.
APSP, UhuruRadio.com.
Uhuru Radio is developing a new programming schedule to include more music, cultural, educational, political, and multilingual programs from around the world. We are professionalizing the technical delivery of our programming, improving our sound quality and presentation. We are working to make our audio stream more accessible through mobile devices and distribution networks. This is your media, Uhuru News, Uhuru Radio, and the Burning Spear newspaper, the voice of the International African Revolution. We rely on your support to get the truth out about our struggle for freedom. Become a member today. Your donation of any amount will make a difference.
APSP, UhuruRadio.com.
Nanga Def, I'm speaking to all of my sisters and brothers in Senegal, the Gambia, Mauritania, and the Wolof diaspora, and that is greetings in Wolof. But this is Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Richmond, sometimes called Jalali, and we're getting ready to play some great music from Los Angeles, California. This is some music that I'm very familiar with. We're going to play Make Me Yours by Betty Swan. We're going to play The Jerk by the Larks. We're going to play Eminem and the Peanuts, the Philly, and that's a group that I used to be a part of. But Betty Swan was, I met Betty Swan in Grambling, Louisiana in 1963. I spent the summer of 1963 in Louisiana, and I met Betty Swan. And I always thought that Betty Swan was my cousin. Some people say she's my cousin, and some people say she's not related to me. But her name is Betty Jean Champion, and she was either born in Shreveport or grew up in Arcadia, and I was born in Arcadia. But the next thing I knew, Betty Swan was on Money Records, and we signed with Money Records. When I say we, the Eminem and the Peanuts, and also on the label was Don Julian and the Larks, and they featured a young man by the name of Ted Watkins and Charlie Morrison. And so we're going to listen to Betty Swan, a song called Make Me Yours, and the Jerk by the Larks, and the Philly by Eminem and the Peanuts. All of us were signed to Money Records.
And Money Records was in a place called Dolphins of Hollywood on Vernon and Central. Around the corner, years later, was the headquarters of the Los Angeles chapter of the Black Panther Party. But let us listen to Betty Swan.
Came along just to have your tender ways, thrills me for days and days. I don't care what nobody says, I want you for always. Now that I've found you, I wanna stay around. So make me yours, make me yours. You already conquered my heart and my soul. Now I want you to take full control.
Listening to Betty Swan, and I remember leaving Los Angeles, and this song, I listened to this song all the way across the country. And when I arrived in Toronto, Canada, I remember turning on the news one day and watching the news. They were showing an item from Tel Aviv in Israel, and they were playing Make Me Yours in a discotheque. But big hit record. Now we want to go to the Larks. Now the Larks, many of the Larks went to John C. Fremont. Don Julian of the Larks, a legendary figure in Los Angeles. Don Julian and the Meadowlarks, he started in the 50s. But Don was much older than all of us. But Ted Watkins actually went to John C. Fremont and Thomas A. Edison High School, junior high school with me. And Charlie Morrison went to Manual Arts, but we're going to listen to the Larks and Eminem and the Peanuts.
Up above our heads again, if you will look up there. I'll say if you will look up there, you. That is. Up there. There you are. Hey! Oh, that's a good group. Now, this is, I have a funny feeling that you may get a little out of hand with this, because this is what you've been waiting for. So have fun, just don't crawl the walls or anything. Ladies and gentlemen, here are the Larks with the Jerk.
Hey.
Diasporic music on Uhuru Radio. We were listening to Eminem and the Peanuts, and that was
a group that I was a part of. The lead singer of that song was Willie Malone, a brother from Texas who used to live two doors down the street from me. Pat White, who was Willie's wife, she was from Chicago. Tommy Darro, who was from New Orleans, Louisiana. He also went to Fremont with us, and Pat went to Fremont. But we are going to continue with our guests. Our guest is coming on at 3:30, Janet Baker. And this is a song that was recorded with Jesse Belvin. Basically, what they did was when Natalie Cole and Nat King Cole did their duet together, basically someone put together Janet Baker's voice with Jesse Belvin's voice. And this was recorded a couple of years ago. This is a song called Looking for Love, and it's by the late, great Jesse Belvin and Janet Baker, who we are going to be interviewing at 3:30. This is Looking for Love.
Looking for love, somebody true. I looked at you and wanted you only. Looking for love, storybook love, like I've never known.
Looking for love, wanting so much, love's tender touch. When I was so lonely, arms that invite, lips that excite, I call you my own.
Within my arms now I hold you. At last I found the one I could adore. But you're afraid, though I told you. I want you, I want you, I want you forevermore. I always knew,
I always knew
there would be you,
there would be you.
So lonely too,
so.
And wanting to find
me,
I'll love you so,
I'll love you so.
You'll never go,
you'll never go.
Looking for love,
looking for love.
Looking for love,
looking for love.
Looking for love.
Thank you.
You lied. You said that you love me. Oh, what can I do? Oh, what can I do?
Information, ideas, reality. That's what the Burning Spear newspaper offers you each month. Truth about government, society, entertainment, and the world around you. The Burning Spear is the oldest Black Power newspaper in existence, and your one-year subscription is only $25. Get the insight and perspective that the mass media machine cannot and will not deliver. Read dynamic articles on the most pressing issues affecting the lives of African workers in the U.S., Africa, and around the world. Each month, you'll find real political analysis of the crisis of parasitic capitalism, insight into world and local events, and a focus on the realities and struggles in the heart of the hood, expressing the vision and voice of the African working class. Uncompromising truth, unwavering focus. The Burning Spear newspaper. This is Black Power in the 21st century. Subscribe today and don't get fooled again. Order your subscription now. Go to burningspearmarketplace.com and click on Spear. That's burningspearmarketplace.com and click on Spear. Uhuru.
You are listening to Diet Spork Music on Uhuru Radio. We were listening to Eminem and the Peanuts, and Eminem and the Peanuts featured a young man by the name of Tommy Durow. Tommy Durow and Willie Malone, Don Malone, and they were basically, we basically took Open Up Your Eyes was basically a takeoff on Girl of My Dreams. If you listen to those two songs, someone was listening very closely to Jesse Belvin and Eugene Church. And joining me on the line from Los Angeles, California, is Jeanette Baker. We had Ms. Baker on last week, and Jeanette Baker is a permanent fixture in the Los Angeles music situation. She's performed, lived in Los Angeles. She lived in Europe, and she recently received a lot of honors and is getting a lot of attention in Los Angeles, and we basically want to let her. We don't talk about a lot of things today, but I think Ms. Baker, I would like you to reiterate the fact that you're getting a little bit of attention from the city of Los Angeles in 2014. I think people need to know.
Well, you know,
about
I got an award from the city for my music about 8 years ago.
Right.
The city council gave me an award. And then I'm getting all kind of accolades around here. It's blowing my mind, the El Monte thing. And then I just had the New York people call me. They coming to do a video in about a month, maybe less than that. And then I'm supposed to go to New York for some other kind of award. I just don't know. I'm just overwhelmed. But I want to get back to the fact that we were talking about Central Avenue, because there's a lot of different things that I didn't mention. Like,
yes, ma'am.
Beyond the down the street from the Bill Robinson Theater, going the other way towards Slauson, was a movie called the House called the I think it was the Savoy Theater, and we all used to go there. And then not only that, I cried when they let the Lincoln Theater go, because many great shows were done at the Lincoln Theater. That was part of our heritage, the Lincoln Theater. You know, all the top acts would go in there. Then going.
When you say the top, when you talk about the top acts, we're talking about Duke Ellington and all of the top acts. The biggest acts in music at that time, right?
Yeah, at the Lincoln Theater, and then after that era, the Johnny Otis show and a whole lot of other shows appeared there, and even my father and uncle appeared there, and I appeared there, and then beyond that, on Broadway we had the Brass Rail, and that featured Red Fox when he came here from St. Louis, and Kathy Cooper, who was a wonderful comedian and should have been up there with the top people that are, you know, but at that time it was Red Fox and her, and they packed the joint every weekend. And then we had the 5-4 Ballroom where everybody went and, you know, did shows. And in that area was a very exciting time at that time, because everybody that came into this city, the first place they hit, they wanted to hit that area. Then after John Dolphin got killed, shot, kind of...
John Dolphin, okay. John Dolphin was the founder of Money Records, right?
Yes. And he had Dolphins of Hollywood on Vernon and Central. Now, something happened, like, it was kind of odd, because after he got killed, things just weren't the same on the boulevard anymore, on Central Avenue. And in that area, it just kind of went west. You know what I mean? It just kind of went all over the place. And it kind of blew me away, because we had such wonderful memories, you know, with Ivy Anderson. I was just a kid. I didn't remember her when she came in there with Duke and the Big Band area. So it kind of petered out. Then what happened was, when Huggy Boy, see, when we started working, it wasn't called rock and roll. It was called rhythm and blues. And then Huggy Boy secured up the El Monte Legion Stadium to have his shows there. And the biggest supporters there were the Latino community. And they still support our music. They still buy our music and keep the oldies but goodies alive. Okay, now he started the show there. And at El Monte Legion Stadium, not only did they have the rhythm and blues shows there, but they had the country shows there. They had wrestling there. They had boxing there. They had roller derby. They even had Gorgeous George there. And
I don't want to cut you, but Gorgeous George was really the man who influenced Muhammad Ali. A lot of Muhammad Ali's things came straight from Gorgeous George, right?
Yeah, that's what I heard. But yeah. Gorgeous George was a famous wrestler.
Right.
Very, very flamboyant. Very mm-hmm. flamboyant. Very theatrical. You know what I mean? And
right.
he did shows there. And so to be honored, all of us are honored at the El Monte Metrolink station, just blew me away. Because, you know, I was honored that they picked me. But I used to go there every weekend and work. We'd make so much money, they'd pay us out of waste paper baskets because they had nowhere to put the rest of the money, okay? They'd literally pay us out of waste. They put the money, had nowhere to put the money, so they put it in waste paper baskets. They mm-hmm. were making a killing, and we were making kibbles and bits. So
yeah.
I got a long story about how they did us. But Los Angeles area was very exciting in those days, and even though now we have the Crenshaw area, that what came up after that was the Crenshaw area. And you
But before you talk about the Crenshaw area, I have one question for you.
Okay.
I remember the Fox Theater when I was 9 years old. My mother took me to the Fox Theater, and I remember seeing the headliner was Little Junior Parker, and Bobby Bland was there, but it was Little Junior Parker and Don and Dewey.
My
were
friends.
Don and Dewey were there, and they sang that song, "I'm Leaving It All Up to You." And I remember
yeah.
the women going crazy, and I said, these were two pretty boys out of Louisiana, I believe. And I remember that. What did you ever do anything at the Fox?
Where was the Fox?
On Florence,
now,
and it was a theater. It was a theater, and it was like the Apollo, but it was and they had stage shows there and movies.
I never worked there.
Okay, all right. I just want to get that out
there.
Of the way.
Wow.
And the 5-4, and the 5-4 ballroom. I remember seeing the Wilson Pickett there, and I saw the Temptations when the first time the Temptations came to Los Angeles. I was there. I remember Eddie LaVert was in the audience, and Carl Dice, who became Sigidi Abdullah, he did the SOS band. I met them there. But this is your interview, so let me shut up. You're going to talk about Crenshaw now.
That's okay. Well, you know, then it was the 5-4 ballroom, and then there were shows all around the city and clubs around the city. They had some, I can't remember that club that was out there on 100 and something. They had shows out there. And then there was the California Club. That's the last.
I remember the California. I saw Art Blakey there. I saw the Four Tops there. I saw everybody. I remember
Sam Cooke. I remember seeing Sam Cooke there just before he got killed.
Right.
Yeah.
This is the last time I'm going to cut you, but I remember seeing J.W. Alexander, who was Sam Cooke's manager.
That's right.
He had a white head. He had slightly bald, but he had an afro that was all white, and he was clean enough to cook in dreams, could dance his behind off, and he was always with the the women just loved him because he would just be out on the floor dancing. That was J.W. Alexander. He was a gospel singer, and he played professional Negro League baseball, and he was he was one of the brains behind Sam, correct?
Yeah, a jack of all trades, we used to call him.
Mm-hmm.
Jack of all. Yeah, he did a lot of things, and I remember that the last time I saw Sam Cooke alive was at the California Club, so it blew me away when he got killed. You know what I mean? And then Marla Gibbs took over the California Club years later, I think. Then they had clubs like, oh, now let me think of the clubs. Earl Bostic had a club in the Crenshaw area. I think it was Earl Bostic. And my mind is still, and I'm having a senior moment. But there were several clubs. There were several clubs there that everybody, you know, went to. But I don't think any of the clubs at that time could capture the magic of Central Avenue. You know, the magic, the mystic magic, where everybody came, all different nationalities came down to Central Avenue to see the talent. And
could I ask you a question about the Watkins Hotel?
Watkins
that was a black hotel. But the
That's
Watkins
right.
Hotel, did they have shows there? Was that just where people lived?
Well, I think, I don't want to say something that I'm not aware of. I think I heard they had shows there, but the Watkins Hotel, I remember that one.
That was a black-owned hotel, right?
Yes, it was. Uh-huh. Watkins Hotel. Wow, I haven't heard that one in a long time. But it was just a lot of magic and a lot of pride and dignity. You know what I mean? Even when our people started moving west, you know, and buying the homes, and the white people were moving out, selling to them. And the thing about it is, it was that pride, but it wasn't that magic in that area. You know what I'm saying? That
yes.
It was on Central Avenue because it was a different time. You know, it was a different time, and I wish we could get those times back because our community had pride and dignity in everything they did. With their children, made sure they had great education, and I had a great education. And my grandmother lived on that side of town, but my father moved to Ruth Ellington. Then he later on bought a home in Lambert Park. But the thing about it is, Lambert Park is nice, and I love Lambert Park, but it doesn't have the magic that had. You know what I mean? They're fixing to have the big celebration on Crenshaw. Every year they have it, and thousands of people come. But it's still, maybe it's just that time, because probably the teenagers and the young people that go on Crenshaw now will say later on when they get my age, that was magic. You know,
well, you
what
know,
I mean?
Lambert Park is where my sister lives today. I guess that really is the last bastion of the African American community, is really like Lambert Park, and I understand that they're really trying to move on that. They have like the bookstore, they got the restaurants, they have a nightclub. What's the woman's in there that had the nightclub there? She has a nightclub, and the guy who used to do the Temptations, used to be the Temptations guitarist, Cornelius Grant.
Yeah.
I think he has a little spot there, but I guess, and then in the park, every Sunday in the park, you have the drumming, and I guess is that the last bastion of the black community in Los Angeles?
I think so, but you want to hear something?
Yes, ma'am.
Now all the young white kids, students, and young people with money are buying homes back in the Lambert Park. You see white mothers pushing their babies down Crenshaw Boulevard.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They're moving back in. So
right.
it's a different time, and I think it's going to be a lot better as far as communities coming together and race relations, you know, because the young people don't look at, the majority of the young people, let's say it like that, don't look at color no more. Look at, they're marching in Ferguson as we speak, you know, I mean, all different nationalities. They even have people from out of the country marching in Ferguson all this weekend. All this weekend, if I was well, I would have gone down there and marched with them. But, you know, it's a different time, and the young people of today are beautiful, you know, and they just don't want all this hatred and racism. It's terrible. And
What is your relationship to St. Louis? Now, you're related to Josephine Baker. What is your relationship to St. Louis?
Well, I used to go to St. Louis in the summertime. I'd go to Denver, Colorado, where I had relatives, and I'd go to St. Louis. And I love the activity in St. Louis, but I hated the weather because it gets so humid. I mean, you never get a let up. Like, when it gets hot and humid here, we have cool nights, not in St. Louis. It's like,
well, you know, that's what they were talking about. They let that Michael Brown stay out in that sun for like 4 hours, and everybody talked about how hot St. Louis is.
Yeah,
I know in California. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's humidity there that's so horrible,
mm-hmm.
and in the wintertime, it's colder than a witch's tent. Excuse my language, but it's cold. I always heard that as a kid, but I hated the weather. I loved the activity that was going on because the black people at that time, when I was a teenager and everything, they were very progressive. They had their own nightclubs, the Sportsman's, the Pollard's, and all those wonderful restaurants and nightclubs that they owned in their areas, exclusive places. And that's what I loved about St. Louis. But as far as going back there and living, I don't even like to go there to visit. You know?
Well, let me ask you, I know nothing about Denver. I've never even been to Denver. Like, what was the black community like in Denver when it came to entertainment? And how, you know, did we have our own newspaper and radio station in Denver?
Oh, yes. We had a street called the Five Points in Denver, Colorado. Five Points. That's where everybody, you know, crossed. They had, wait a minute. His name is on the tip of my tongue. He had a club there. Oh, goodness, I know him so well. He had a club there, and, you know, and all the top entertainment would go to his, it's right on the tip of my tongue, I can't think, but it was on the Five Points, and they had their own movies. It wasn't as hip as Los Angeles, but they had their own little thing. It was dignified, and, you know, they had, I used to go over to the Y, MCA across the street, they had a lot of activities. The YWCA, YMCA, and they had, what was the name of it? You know, this has been so long ago. And they had a movie theater there, too, that was popular. And but the Five Points was where the action was at that time. Mm-hmm.
The only person...
India Irie, you know, she's from Colorado.
Ah, in the Irie, I didn't know that. She is one of the very underrated women. She is so talented. It's ridiculous.
She's wonderful. Yes, she is. So it's we got talent coming out of there. And
what's the name of the biggest person coming out of there now? I think Philip Bailey, Earth, Wind, and Fire, the falsetto guy.
Philip Bailey.
He's from Denver, I believe.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's from Denver.
And Vernon Green was from Denver. We used to win.
Oh, you were talking about, was that the Medallions?
The Medallions.
That was the last thing you said last week. We have about, we got about 10 minutes, but you said you were going to talk about the Medallions in last week, yeah.
The Medallions and my family in Denver were friends, and his sister was a DJ,
I can't think of her name, but and I should always remember them. But Vernon and I would do. They had every summer a talent show in the park, and one year he won, and one year I won, and that's how we became friends. Yeah, that's how.
Now, what is Vernon Green and Medallion? What's their biggest hit?
Buick 59 was what their first hit,
mm-hmm.
and they
oh,
had
Buick 59. Yeah, right. Okay.
Yeah, Buick 59, and Vivian Green, that was her name. She was real big there. She had a radio show, and was real popular in Denver, and then they all moved out here. Baby, that's one of the relatives, and Vernon moved out here. When he first got to California, he drove up to my grandmother's house, and I'll never forget it. And they came in, and they said, "We're coming, and we're going to do something here." I said, "Okay," and I had a record. I said, "Okay," I think I told him about Huggy Boy and different, how to get into it, and they did it. And, you know, I really miss them because not only is Vernon gone, his brother Jimmy is gone. And I never will forget when I was at Vernon's funeral and I was there with Vernon's family and Jimmy, never knowing that we were going to lose Jimmy a few years later. But he was very talented. He married a church girl that we grew up with, Marie... what was her last name? First name was Marie. And he married her, and they had a son. And he was trying to do something. And Marie was a singer, too. And her father was in the music business. And I didn't know they had married 2 years later because I was traveling all over the world. And because we were, we went to church together as kids. And so it's the Medallions, they really worked hard to get to where they were, and they made it. And that record, Buick 59, in fact, the Medallions now that they have an extended group of the Medallions, one of the original members, I just saw a show with them about 3 or 4 months ago, and the last number they did was Buick 59, and they brought the house down, you know, because they
they also did a song called The Letter. Yeah, Buick,
the letter. Right.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Right. And, now, Vernon Green, was he handicapped?
Yes, he was.
Right, okay.
Yeah, he was handicapped. He walked with a cane.
Yes,
and I think
right,
he was
right.
born like that. He had problems with his legs.
Yes,
but,
ma'am. Right.
Sammy did, you remember a group called The Premieres? Sammy Yates did Buick 59 with Billy Foster, and Billy is in charge of the group, and what's the other kids? No, you know him well. I can't think of his name right now, but they did put on a show, and the show was great. I mean, and they had that Buick 59. They closed the show with that and brought the house down. Because, you know, they get up and do the actual, like, drive in the car, you know, and and the audience loved it. But the Medallions are still going without Jimmy and Medallions. They still keeping his legacy alive.
I remember Jule Akins, and he used to work at the same place my mother worked at, but... Pardon me, I saw him he came to Toronto. It was the song he had out. Let me tell you about the birds
and the bees. He was a friend of mine, too. In fact, I just talked to his wife, Eddie Mae, about 2 weeks ago. And she's a lovely person. And, Jewel Akins, he's gone. But she has this big party every year on the 4th of July.
Well, there's and one. We
I
only have a
Labor
few more.
Day.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful. But we have a few minutes left, and there's someone I definitely wanted to ask you about who was very, he's a Louisiana man. That was, he wrote the song, oh my goodness, I'm thinking about, I'm looking at him right now. He was in a Percy Mayfield. Please send
Percy
me someone to love. Did you know Percy Mayfield?
Yes, let me tell you how I met him. In the elevator in New York, I had to appear there. And I met him, I was in the elevator, and we started talking, and he said, my name is Percy Mayfield. I said, no, you're not Percy Mayfield. He said, yes, I am. And we became real good friends. Nice man, a real gentleman, you know. Percy Mayfield.
He was one hell of a songwriter, right?
Yes, he was. And he said, he wrote that song, Please Send Me Someone to Love. I think he wrote that, didn't he?
Yes, ma'am. Please send me a song. Everybody's recorded that song. Sade, I mean that.
Yeah. And I met him in the elevator in the hotel we were staying. And was he a nice guy? Boy, he was a nice, so humble. You know, he wasn't braggadocious or anything like that. I didn't detect that. We became good friends after that. And then when I left New York, I didn't see him too much. He'd come out here maybe once or twice, and we'd talk. And then, I don't even know if he's alive.
Percy passed away. But Percy wrote Hit the Road, Jack. He wrote that.
Yeah.
He wrote some Rivers Invitation. They call him the blues poet. That's what they call him, the blues poet.
Right. And he was so nice. And he was so nice to me because I was in New York, and I think I had to get someplace and didn't know how to get there. And he said, well, don't worry about it. I'll get you there. You know? He was really nice. I really
liked him. He's from Minden, Louisiana.
Really? I didn't know
He was born in Minden, and so was a friend of mine by the name of Azizi Johari. She was a Playboy bunny. Azizi Johari, she was on the Richard Pryor show and on the Red Fox show, and she was real close with Marvin Gaye's Janet Hunter. But she's from this. Yeah, I met her in Los Angeles at the Coliseum, and she was messing with me about, where are you from, fool? Because she's a model, you know, and movie star. So who are you? So I say, I was born in Louisiana, and she looked at me and bust out laughing. So was I. So we became very tight after. We only have 2 minutes left. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Oh, it's so many things I could talk about. It's just wonderful talking to you, and you're doing a wonderful job keeping our music alive and educating people about our history. And that's what we have to do with our children. They have to know who they are, because they don't want to educate them in this country. And it's people like you that are keeping the dream alive and keeping our history alive. And I really want to thank you. I think you're a marvelous person. Can't wait till you get back here. We didn't get a chance to see each other. We talked to each other, but we didn't get a chance to really see each other. But I really want you to promise me that you stop here, and you're invited as a guest in my home if you want to stay here. So thank you for what you're doing for our people and the community. I greatly appreciate it, because you're one of the gems of our history.
I really appreciate your contribution, because every time I speak to you, I learn more and more about the history of Los Angeles, the history of black music, and how the impact that our people had in Europe and in Australia, and you're a world traveler, and I've always respected. I love to travel. So,
I tell young people all the time. I work with young people. I got a new artist here that's from Lithuania. That you wait till you hear him. I'm hoping to get him recorded in February, and he's a youngster. He's 19 years old. I got another black artist. He's Lithuanian. I got a black artist, and I got a Mexican artist. I'm excited about all three of them, and I'm going to be recording them in February.
Okay. But Ms. Jeanette Baker, we have to go, because this show is computerized. They're going to cut us off. So thank you very much.
You take care, darling.
All
bye.
Right. And I would like to thank Lisa Watson for her technical brilliance today keeping the show together. And this is Norman Otis Richmond saying we will see you in the whirlwind, and we will be black next week. Uhuru.